I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this,
but we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
Hey there, I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
The lawn is a contentious battlefield in the fight against climate change. The two sides?
Those who believe that the lawn is the rightful way to garden, and those who understand that in a climate crisis, the very least that anyone can do lies right outside their front doorstep.
I'm Carol Hills. Today, Canadian gardeners are getting in trouble for rewilding their lawns. We'll also hear about fashion at the Paris Olympics, where up-and-coming designers are showcasing their talents in the Parade of Nations.
The pressure that weighs is immense because you're trying to make a nation happy.
Plus, baseball in Argentina, the solstice in Latvia, and public toilets in Tokyo that you can talk to.
Hi, toilet.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. Now, today is technically the first day of summer in the U.S., and it's the solstice everywhere. Scientifically speaking, the summer solstice is the day when the northern hemisphere reaches its maximum tilt toward the sun, so the longest and sunniest day of the year, or peak summer. So to kick off today's show, we're bringing you a bunch of summery stories from around the globe, starting with a solstice celebration. For people in Northern Europe and the Baltics in particular, this celestial event is known as midsummer, and it's a really big deal. The World's Daniel Offman reports from Riga, the Latvian capital, where people have been celebrating all week.
In Latvia, the summer solstice holiday has two names, Jāni and Ligo. We'll call it Jāni. It's celebrated on June 23rd and 24th, but throughout the week leading up to that night, the holiday spirit is already in the air. Across Riga, the city hosts public events all devoted to midsummer festivities. At this event, at a park in northern Riga, families gather for folk singing and dancing, paired with traditional Latvian midsummer snacks. Antra Dreje is one of the organizers of this event. She explains some of the Jāni traditions.
Mostly we are sitting around the fireplace and cooking some special foods like Jāņu sirs. This is a special cheese with cumin and drinking beer.
The Jāņu sirs cheese eating and beer drinking happens over the course of many hours.
The tradition is that you have to stay awake all the night to see the three-colored sun rising up. This is all about magic, all about rituals and about health and fertility, all those traditions.
Dreje says that many of these practices stem from old Latvian pagan traditions connected to nature. These rituals were preserved and passed down from generation to generation. One of the ways that people connect to nature during Jāni is by making flower crowns and wreaths. This is Baiba Sproja. About a dozen children gather around her as she demonstrates how to properly weave and braid a flower crown. Of course, she's wearing one herself. Sproja explains that there's a lot of meaning behind the flower crown because in her tradition, the practice of weaving it together symbolizes the making of a family. Sproja says that she's been making flower crowns since she was a child. She says midsummer is by far her favorite time of year.
This is the biggest festival, the biggest thing what all Latvians are waiting. The Christmas is not comparing to this one, not even close. This is the main point in the whole year what we are waiting.
Most Latvians share the tradition of making a bonfire, dancing around it, and even jumping over it. But Sproja says that for her, what she's doing right now, teaching kids how to make flower crowns, is one of the most meaningful aspects of the holiday.
I'm very happy that the kids are coming and they're learning from me, because I know that when they're going to be grown up, they will know how to make them and they can teach their own kids. This kind of thing is very special for our next generation.
Sproja says that in addition to making flower crowns, eating cheese and dancing around bonfires, many families have their own unique Jani practices. Iveta Vitola, who's also attending this midsummer event, describes one of her family traditions.
In our place, we have special ritual for sunrise. We are sitting on the ground and screaming very loud. It's very special. Because everybody, neighbors know, 4 o'clock, 4:15, you should be there.
For Vitola, this holiday and that screaming isn't just a fun ritual. Over the years, it's become meaningful, even therapeutic for her.
I think for me, it's like to scream and to dance and to sing and to just be in nature all the night. And it starts already when I was like this. We were so happy to be awake all the night.
When she says like this, she shows how small she was when she first started celebrating Jani. And she says that all these years later, it's still her favorite holiday. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Riga, Latvia.
As we just heard, summer can be a time of celebration, but it also comes with chores, like mowing the lawn. Now, the best argument against mowing isn't that we just don't want to. There's also a compelling environmental argument. And that's where the rewilding movement comes in. Proponents say natural gardens and lawns increase biodiversity and drought resistance. Grass does require lots of watering, and lawnmowers can be gas guzzlers. But rewilding practitioners in Canada are up against local regulations. Nina Marie Lister teaches ecological design at Toronto Metropolitan University, and she's dealt with this herself as a gardener.
Rewilding is about making a kind of happy mixture of perhaps more ornamental species or cultivated species, and then trying to bring back some of the native species that are traditionally ecologically adapted to where we are. And maybe they are also species that might be changing their ranges as the climate changes. So rewilding is really about moving forward from where we are now, but making space for nature.
Now, you're a rewilder. What have you replaced your traditional grass with?
Well, lawns are intensive. They're the largest crop in North America, for one thing. We were interested in providing more shade, providing places for stormwater to be infiltrated or slowly soaked in. And in my house, we happen to live on a beautiful corner lot that's quite steep. And neither my husband or my sons or I really felt like pushing a mower up and down a steep hill. So we thought that it might be make more sense to plant with nature. So allowing some of the species that are native to colonize that area and to encourage them together with some of the species that were ornamental. So for example, we have trees that are not native to our area, but no one's planning to cut them down. We simply underplanted them with many of the species that are native to the northern shore of the Great Lakes where we live. And that allowed a really lovely habitat to emerge for our songbirds that migrate through the area, for local bees, solitary bees in particular, and of course pollinators like monarch butterfly that are now surprisingly listed as endangered in our area.
If I looked at your garden, would there be kind of long grass and different plants? There's no mowing required at this point, is there?
No mowing required, although I will say we do cut pathways through it.
Now, here comes the interesting part. In Toronto, where you live, you've actually come up against a long grass and weed bylaw.
The weeds and grass bylaw or property standards bylaw required people to trim their grass to a particular height. That's very common throughout North America. Toronto's not unusual in that way. The problem is we didn't have grass. And when the bylaw officers came to enforce the bylaw, we asked, which grasses would you like us to cut? And of course, bylaw officers oftentimes have no training in plant identification, so they can't identify those plants. And that's a problem. And what's more important, most cities also have very progressive policies that support the planting of native species on public land, but yet they punish individual homeowners for trying to do the same thing in their private property.
Did you have to pay a fine or mow your lawn?
No, we didn't. My house and garden were charged with a notice of violation. We objected on the grounds that as a university professor teaching planners to write bylaws, this seemed very odd. And in fact,
This had already been challenged in court. The city backed down. They retracted the notice of violation and invited me to participate with many other subject matter experts to rewrite the bylaw, which is what we did for 2022.
So are there a lot of these bylaws in Canada still, or are they gradually being changed?
Well, many of them are in the process of being changed, largely because of the precedent that was set in Toronto in 2022. But they exist widely and broadly. We did a study that showed at least 14 municipalities across Canada and the United States still have bylaws that are focused on the norm of the lawn. Some of them are in the process of being changed, but in individual municipalities, we still see these battles coming up. And really what this is a culture clash between those who believe that the lawn is the rightful way to garden and those who believe that in a climate crisis with biodiversity loss accelerating, if you're lucky enough to have a garden, you can rewild to the extent possible in your area.
Nina Marie Lister teaches ecological design at Toronto Metropolitan University. When it comes to sports, baseball is pure summer. Ice cold beer, a hot dog, and a blazing hot seat. Baseball's popularity isn't quite the global phenomenon that, say, soccer is, but it's big in Venezuela, and as a result, it's making its way to Argentina. Close to 8 million Venezuelans left their country in the last decade, and the majority have settled elsewhere in South America, bringing a passion for baseball with them. From Buenos Aires, the world's Tibis Isaiah reports.
Baseball is not popular in Argentina. The average Argentine knows very little about the sport, and there is only one baseball field in the capital of Buenos Aires, a city with close to 16 million people. But if you pass by this field on any given weekend, you will find a lot of activity. In the past few years, baseball is attracting more players and more fans, and it looks like there is a clear reason for that.
It's
thanks to the arrival of Venezuelans, says Roberto Branchini, director of Argentina's National Baseball Association. About 250,000 of displaced Venezuelans now live in Argentina, among them talented young baseball players. While in Argentina, soccer overshadows any other sport, Venezuela is a baseball powerhouse, sending many players to the U.S. major leagues.
Aportaron un nivel de competencia que antes no había.
Branchini says the arrival of Venezuelan players raised the bar for baseball in Argentina. It brought more quality and quantity. This is especially true with the young kids. In a recent game between two local teams, most of the players were from Venezuela. Luis Cova, a 9-year-old on his uniform, is warming up before the game. He says he's been playing baseball since he was 3.
Acuña, Ronald Acuña Jr. En los Bravos de Atlanta.
He says his idol is Venezuelan outfielder Ronald Acuña with the Atlanta Braves, and that when he grows up, he wants to play professional ball in the United States. His family moved to Argentina in 2018, running away from repression and economic hardship. His dad, Carlos Cova, is shouting words of encouragement from the bleachers.
El béisbol para nosotros es todo. Así que
baseball
bueno,
is everything for us in Venezuela, he says. It's in our blood. He was surprised to learn that his son was able to continue practicing baseball in Argentina. But still, baseball hasn't been quite the same as back home. Cava points out that the competition level isn't as good as it is in Venezuela, and there are limitations for immigrants to represent a foreign country. But it's been a great way to integrate into the new culture, he says. Mateo Garcia, an Argentinian player, says baseball has allowed him to get to know Venezuelan culture. I'm with Venezuelans all the time, he says, and my friends inspire me to get better. The rise of baseball thanks to Venezuelan immigrants is also happening in Colombia and Peru, all countries where soccer dominates. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
A quick update on a story we reported yesterday. A high court in the southern African country of Namibia today declared two laws unconstitutional that had criminalized same-sex acts between men. The laws dated back to the colonial era. Friedel Dalsab, the activist who brought the case, told Reuters, "It's a great day for Namibia. It won't be a crime to love anymore." The Namibian government has 21 days to appeal the court's decision. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. There's some promising news this week about treating Alzheimer's disease. Researchers have been working extensively with one family in Colombia to study a devastating inherited form of Alzheimer's that the family has endured for generations. And that work has yielded some intriguing results. Neuropsychologist Yaquil Quiros is the lead researcher on the study. She's a professor in the departments of psychiatry and neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School here in Boston. Dr. Quiros, before we get into the science, tell us about this Colombian family.
So yes, in Colombia, we have right now more than 6,000 individuals that are blood relatives that belong to this extended family, the largest extended family with early onset Alzheimer's disease. And we have been studying these families now for almost 40 years.
Wow. So this one family, you're looking at kind of 6,000 members of this extended family. And what are the genetic components of this family in terms of their connection to dementia?
The ones that actually carry a genetic mutation for early onset Alzheimer's disease, they have a mutation in one gene that is called presenilin-1. And they have what we call the PISA mutation, and they are pretty much destined to develop Alzheimer's disease in their 40s.
So some people in the family have a particular mutation, which means that they have the good chance or do develop early onset Alzheimer's in their 40s.
Correct.
But others in the extended family don't.
Correct.
So this one mutated gene, the Christchurch mutation in the APOE3, that can delay the onset of Alzheimer's.
Correct.
By an average of how many years?
In the individual that have two copies, it delayed the onset by almost 30 years. And in individuals that carry one copy, it delayed the onset about 5 to 10 years.
Wow. So if you have two copies, as many as 30-year delay.
Yes.
Or if you have a single copy.
5 to 10.
5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there was one woman with two copies of this mutation, and she didn't develop dementia until her 70s. So she got sort of an extra 30 years.
Correct.
That's amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
What are the implications for this for the larger population?
What we are doing now, we started with the individual that we identified in 2019, is developing treatments based on the protection that she had.
So will this family, the subject of this study, will they themselves benefit from this research?
Yeah, that's the hope, that they will be the first ones to benefit.
So you got to know this family in Colombia yourself.
Yes, I'm from Colombia originally, yes.
So this has a lot of meaning for you in terms of a researcher, in terms of your home country, in terms of this family. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
How unusual is it to have this kind of extended family study? It sounds very unusual.
Yes, it's very unusual. And the same, like, what we are learning from them and working with them, it has been a great opportunity to understand the most common form of Alzheimer's disease, because it actually, all the work that we have been doing in the past almost 40 years had helped us to understand what's happening in the disease in general.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, super interesting.
So what's the next step? What are you hoping to find out next?
Exactly. So now, like the same, we're trying to advance all the treatment development. We have an antibody and we're trying to get closer to bringing it to clinical trials. And second, we are trying to understand better what happens with the protection with the Christchurch mutation and those individuals that carry this mutation.
So basically kind of further refine the research to figure out how to adapt it into actual treatment for people at risk for Alzheimer's.
Correct.
It's amazing.
I think it's pretty cool.
Yaquil Quiros is a neuropsychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. Food plays a big role in rites of passage of all kinds, and in many cultures, that includes the first moments of a child's life. In fact, there are lots of places where people believe that eating the right food can ease a mother's postpartum recovery. As part of Minnesota Public Radio News North Star Journey series, Hannah Young explains.
Just outside St. Paul in Invergrove Heights, a hot pot bubbles on the stove in Juchi Yang's kitchen. She starts with Cornish hens, seasoned with lime leaves and lemongrass frozen from last summer's backyard harvest. She's recovering after giving birth to a daughter in February, and food has a lot to do with that. Yang's parents immigrated to the United States from Laos and Thailand after the Vietnam War in the 1970s. She picks a book on Hmong herbs written by her aunt and reads aloud.
Which translates to red duck feet. And this one just kind of helps, apparently, to regain strength and endurance.
The veggies.
The traditional way is to eat the same meal every day for the first month. It's known as the chicken diet to the Hmong people, a traditional holistic soup recipe made from herbs and young chicken that has been passed down from generation to generation. It's considered the epitome of home cooking and a comfort dish.
This one I kind of eat. You can eat these or just let it like soak into the liquid as well. But this one I don't mind eating. It's really good.
While she cooks, Yang says this knowledge of postpartum care is important to pass down to new generations of Hmong who are growing up in America. She thinks about it often.
So this is something that, you know, as my daughter, you know, way, way down the line when she gets older, you know, when she does have children, I would want her to follow the same diet or purification, you know, how to eat, what to eat, how to treat her body when she gives birth.
Being expected to eat the same food for a month can feel overbearing, Yang says. But it's a tradition meant to keep cultural knowledge alive by sharing what they know. It's exactly this kind of sharing that motivates Alexia Pedersen to introduce her clients to her Mexican culinary roots. Pedersen is a chef and a doula. Here in one of her clients' kitchens in St. Paul, she cooks dozens of pre-made meals for an expectant mother ahead of her due date.
Gonna have to tell Claire about that next time I see her.
Inspired by traditional recipes from her childhood, Pedersen gives her clients' meals a Hispanic touch. She learned to cook from her mother and her abuela, her grandmother.
I think there is a little bit of like that grandmother or mother's touch that we all have in one way or the other that makes food just taste better. I don't like, because it's someone else that made it with love. So even if we try to recreate some of these recipes, it may not always taste the same because it was created with love by someone else.
Some of those recipes include caldos, broths with floating bones, chiles and vegetables, barley horchata, sopas, albóndigas, tacos, and more. Pedersen teaches her clients about the nutritional benefits of each ingredient, like collagen for skin and hair, protein, breast milk production, and hydration. And cooking these meals and sharing them with her clients helps Pedersen too.
And so every time like I'm able to make these foods for like my clients, I just feel like my grandmother is with me again, that I'm like thinking about like my Aunt Bita and like my dad and like my family. It's like this continuation of this family tradition.
Whether it's caldos, bone broth, or red duck feet herbs, these foods mean comfort and nurture. Often what a new mother needs most. For the World, I'm Hannah Yang.
More global stories coming your way. This is The World. The Olympics are always a chance for athletes to strut their stuff, but this year, the Summer Games are in Paris, the fashion capital of the world, which takes things to a whole new level.
For us to be able to show up, it gives us a sense of legitimacy and the eyeballs and the exposure.
That story and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. If you live in Iran, it's dangerous to criticize the government. And that danger extends to Iranians living outside the country. Critics have been kidnapped and assassinated well beyond Iran's borders. Reporter Fariba Nawa is in Istanbul. She's been investigating the suspicious death of one dissident who settled in Turkey after fleeing Iran. During his exile, Iran's government made it clear he was being watched and even threatened his life. In 2022, Mohammad Shabani died after falling from a fourth-story balcony. In this latest installment, Fariba goes to Mohammad's old apartment in Istanbul and finds out that his landlord, Ali Kamal Akbalut, has been trying to solve the mystery for himself. The piece begins at Mohammad's old apartment with Fariba talking with the landlord through her interpreter, Beril Eski. And just a word of caution, this episode describes violence, including suicide.
Can he give us kind of a tour of what he saw and where he saw it?
The few times that Ali Kamal had visited Mohammed to talk about rent and bills, he noticed that Mohammed kept his home tidy. But when Ali Kamal came in with the police, he saw things had changed.
He wasn't the same person anymore. The house was so messy, extremely messy.
Even and the before bedroom. That, he would have been, he was very organized.
Yeah, super organized, he says.
It's not messy in here anymore. All of Mohammed's stuff has been cleared away and new tenants have moved in. It's a two-bedroom apartment with a bathroom, a nice-sized kitchen, and a large terrace. Ali Kamal says when he walked in with the police, they noticed the blood.
Şuralarda kanlar vardı. Mutfağın buralarında kanlar vardı. Mutfağın girişinde.
Blood droplets on the floor in the entrance, and there was droplets on top of this.
Yes, he points to the sink in the kitchen. We're in the kitchen.
He thinks he went back and forth between the bathroom and here. Most of the blood was in the bathroom.
So before Mohammed fell from his balcony, he was injured somehow. Ali Kamal says he saw razors on the bathroom floor. There was also a sign on the kitchen door.
Biz eve polislerle beraber girdik. İlk buraya girdim. Gaz yazısını görünce polis beyler kimse
It said gas here. They could already smell it when they were entering the building. The police said nobody touch anything. There's a gas leak. So he went out and turned off the gas.
Hemen gaz çektim ben. Gazı kapattım. Orada vana var.
When Ali Kamal returned to Mohammed's apartment and tried to open the kitchen window, it was taped shut.
Bak. Şu köşeler dahil olmak üzere.
He taped all the corners everywhere so that the gas would stay inside and poison him. So it was all taped so that no air would come inside.
I step away to look around the apartment on my own.
So it's just a bit eerie to be in, you know, in a place where there was so much bloodshed, literally. There's a long corridor, and along the corridor you see the bedroom and then the living room, and the last stop is the kitchen and the big terrace. But then there's this door, and I wonder what this leads to. He told us there's no second entrance. Uh-huh. It's like another terrace toward the back, facing the back street. I wonder if anybody could have climbed up this place.
The CCTV footage that Ali Kamal reviewed showed the entrance of the building, but there's no security camera on the street behind the building. I asked Ali Kamal if someone could get in from the back terrace.
Ha şey Batman gibi bir şey falansa, örümcek adam, Spider-Man gibi bir şeyse ona bir şey demem. Açsak da hayatta çıkamaz.
Yani he says you'd have to be Batman to climb the back terrace. There's no fire escape. It's the other terrace, the larger one in the front of the building that Mohammed fell from.
Şurada çamaşırlık var. Bak şurada çamaşırlık var. Koltuklar şurada.
The terrace is huge, almost half the size of the apartment. Ali Kamal says Mohammed would hang his laundry out there, but he neglected to cover the furniture when it rained, and he rarely sat out there.
Burada oturuyor. İntihar teşebbüslerini yapıyor. Onları beceremiyor büyük olasılıkla.
Just like the back terrace, there's no clear way to access this terrace from outside, at least not without special equipment. Near the corner of the terrace, we peek over the edge. This could have been the last place Mohammed stood. There's a garden directly below. Then beyond that, the street where Mohammed landed.
Bu direkt iki adımda hızlı bir şekilde atlıyor aşağıya.
The garden is like 4 meters. So he has to like take first step, second step on here, and then on the third step outside, he should have jumped.
Hızlı bir şekilde ileri itiyor kendini.
Fast and like threw himself out because otherwise he would have fallen into the garden because the garden is like 4 meters long.
Yolun ortasına düşmez. Yolun tam ortasına düşüyor.
He fell right in the middle of the street.
Ali Kamal says he found the footage of the moment it happened.
We'd like to see the video, right?
Vallahi nasıl diyeyim? Videoyu izleteyim mi? İzleyeceğim mi videoyu? Yeah.
It's on the phone. Okay, let's see it.
The video is hard to look at. I don't know what to say. I watch it in the most analytical way I can, trying to remain detached. Here's what I see. Muhammad suddenly falls into the frame and hits the street. He has a blanket wrapped around him. His slippers are still on, just like his neighbor said. Ali Kamal replays the video in slow motion. It doesn't show what happened upstairs, on the terrace. Still, Ali Kamal says what happened is clear.
Yani atlayana kadar çok teşebbüste bulunmuş. Öncelikle bileklerini kesmiş. Banyonun içinde kan izleri vardı.
We found droplets of blood in the bathroom, and then he turned on the gas in the kitchen and like isolated every little corner, every hole, so that it would poison him. He failed, and he wrote gas on a paper and put it on the kitchen's door, so that if anyone breaks in, they would know that the gas is open, and then he threw himself. Like, he tried different ways to commit suicide.
Kapattık, gazı kapattık, gazı kestik komple. Ondan sonra polis işte içerilerini araştırmaya başladı. Ama Z ile değil, S ile yazmış.
Why does the family suspect it was a murder? They said that there were wounds on his back. What does he know about that?
Bıçaklanmış bir insanın o şekilde oradan atlaması çok zor. Gerçekten.
So there is no way with such a wound a person can jump from the terrace and jump 4 meters away from the building. There is no way a person can do that with such a wound. If he had such a wound, there would be blood everywhere.
Ali Kamal says he didn't see a knife with blood in the apartment, only the razors in the bathroom. He also says the police left evidence behind. He says they took Muhammad's phone, but not his internet router. They left his medications and didn't seem interested in his laptop case, which was empty. Where was the computer? But they did take the note.
Tek sayfa olarak masanın üzerindeydi. Bir şeyi vardı.
And there was the note. He saw the note, but the police officers didn't see the note in the beginning.
Pardon. Ajandaya benzer bir şeyi vardı.
Ajanda gibi. Okay, it had a date. It's like ajanda neydi ya?
It's an agenda.
Agenda, yes. It was an agenda paper. You could see the date. Yeah,
calendar paper.
Torn from an agenda, the page.
It was a suicide note sitting right there on Muhammad's kitchen table.
And if he has the letter, I'd really like to see the letter.
Bir de mektubu da görmek istiyorum.
Ali Kamal took a picture of it with his phone.
Police didn't let him turn the letter over and take the photo of the other side.
Why?
Actually, because it's an evidence. It's a crime scene, in the beginning.
İlk sayfayı çekememişim. Ben ikinci sayfayı çekmişim.
Oh, okay. He took the photo of the back side, not the front side. So we know the conclusion.
Ali Kamal shows me the picture on his phone of the back page of the note. It's written in Farsi.
Oh, he has a beautiful handwriting. Yeah, so he's showing us the note in Farsi. It's very small. I can't see it.
Do you need your glasses?
Yeah, definitely. Hang on a second.
The note was written on an Iranian planner from 2018, the year Muhammad fled Iran. "We are not free even after we die," it reads, and it requests that he be cremated. There's no crematorium in Turkey, and in Iran, cremation's forbidden. "Could you please send my body to another country that can accommodate this request?" The note reads. And also, "This is me being naive, and I will not get any results. It's like riding on water." The note is signed Mohammed Shabani, both in Farsi and English.
He doesn't believe it's a murder.
But I'm not convinced yet. We need to see the court and police records. We need to know what was on his phone and where was the laptop. How do we even know the suicide note was really Muhammad's? We don't. Police took fingerprints from the note, but the case file didn't say if they identified whose prints they were.
some of the evidence was sent to the lab, criminal lab, to be examined, including the letter. But because they don't have a specialist in Arabic who can...
In the Arabic alphabet,
they couldn't determine whether the handwriting is original and belongs to Muhammad.
This means a critical piece of evidence went unanalyzed. The police couldn't verify who wrote the letter, so we decided we would.
For help with thoughts of suicide, call or text 988. The circumstances of Mohammad Shabani's death seem clear, but to rule out the Iranian regime's involvement, Fariba goes looking into how Iran's foreign operations against dissidents actually work. That's on the next episode of Lethal Dissent, an in-depth investigation from The World and on Spec. Look for full episodes of Lethal Dissent each Friday in The World's podcast feed. Paris is considered the fashion capital of the world. This summer, though, with the Olympics in town, Paris will also be a global sports capital. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how the two industries are teaming up for a summer in the spotlight.
Mark Guiducci follows the fashion industry like many people follow sports.
Who's going to what house and what models are walking what show? There are players. There are coaches. Those are our teams.
And Vogue, he says, is the ESPN of it all. Guiducci is the magazine's creative editorial director. He calls me from Paris, where he's getting ready for this year's Vogue World event, a genre-busting and theatrical runway show like no other. Vogue World kicked off in New York in 2022 before heading to London last year. This year, it will take over the Place Vendôme. A promotional video shows supermodel Gigi Hadid running the 100-meter dash in strappy pumps and diving into a pool wearing Chanel hoop earrings. Guiducci says the event will celebrate 100 years of French fashion and sport.
We're breaking the show into 10 chapters, one for each decade of the last 100 years, and we're pairing that decade with a sport.
For example, Guiducci says the 1980s is paired with martial arts.
And the 1940s will be dedicated to aquatics and water sports because 1946 is the year that the bikini was invented in Paris as an ingenious way to deal with post-war rationing.
Designers were forced to ration fabric, so swimsuits got smaller.
So there's like these connections between fashion history and the sports that we're choosing.
The cast includes two horses, plus more than 130 models and 250 athletes. Guiducci is tight-lipped on exactly who is taking part, but he promises both French and international faces. Vogue World Paris is this Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can stream it for free on YouTube. Fashion is also expected to take center stage when the Olympics start next month. Like in Tokyo and all recent Olympics, the opening ceremony's parade of nations is as much of a runway show as it is the official start to the games. Some teams are dressed by industry bigwigs, like Team USA donning Ralph Lauren. But this year in Paris, some countries are being outfitted by smaller brands.
For us to be able to show up, it gives us a sense of legitimacy and the eyeballs and the exposure.
Lanny Smith started Actively Black, a premium athleisure brand, in 2020. He says the brand is built for the entire diaspora of Africans, African Americans, and Caribbeans. This summer, Team Nigeria will wear his label during the opening and closing ceremonies,
which are actually being made in Lagos, Nigeria. So we're able to contact a factory there. We wanted the authenticity to really show through.
The exact designs are a secret until the big day, but I ask him to share what he can.
You've got like some traditional fabrics that are mixed with some more athleisure, modern pieces.
Smith and his team are also designing the competition uniforms for Nigeria's track and field athletes.
They've actually got some athletes that have some opportunities to medal. So being able to have the athletes actually competing in Actively Black at the Olympics and in such a premier event with track and field is super exciting.
Laura Weber is also gearing up for the games. Her company, LW Pearl, is the official outfitter of Team Ireland.
The pressure that weighs is immense because you're trying to make a nation happy.
Weber started planning the outfits back in 2021. She researched the team's Olympic archives going back 100 years and landed on an opening ceremony look of a white double-breasted jacket and sporty pants. Each athlete will also wear custom-made sneakers and a county patch.
We don't just have national pride, we have county pride, and it's just a really nice token for the Olympians.
The embroidered patch is on the jacket sleeve, uniquely representing each county with beads, sequins, and stones. Weber hopes it serves a practical purpose, too.
They're not all going to have met before the Olympics. So at the meeting point of the Olympics, when they're wearing their uniforms, it might be a really nice like speaking point for them, like, oh, let me see your county patch.
Weber, who was born and raised in Dublin and is now based in New York, says designing these outfits is a huge honor.
It was something about like going back to my country and saying, this is to thank you for all the opportunity that I've been given for my entire life. You know, it's nice to be able to go back and do something for your country.
The opening ceremony is set to take place on the River Seine on Friday, July 26th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. If I could turn your attention for just a few minutes to public toilets. Best case scenario, there's a clean one nearby when you need it. Worst case scenario, let's not even go there. But what if a public toilet could inspire not dread, but joy? That's the idea behind a government project in Tokyo. The World's Patrick Wynn has the story.
I'm on a mission to find a toilet that talks.
This toilet can be operated by using your voice.
That's Tokyo's own voice-operated commode, featured in this promo video about a wondrous line of public toilets. There are 17 total, designed by world-class architects, each commissioned by officials in Shibuya, one of the busiest sections in Tokyo, known for its nightlife. The most famous toilet not only talks, it listens, flushing when you tell it to, and it even plays pop music. As the toilet promo video says,
these iconic toilets became the new face of Tokyo.
The Tokyo Toilet Project started in 2020, but debuted new facilities as recently as last year. This spring, local officials started an official van tour of all 17 toilets. Eager to meet that talking toilet, I bought a ticket, only to realize it's one of the last stops on the tour. But that's okay. All the toilets are pretty cool. My tour guide, who asked that I just call him Mr. Kazaki, he tells me foreign tourists can't believe these exquisite bathrooms are free public facilities on the side of the road.
Yes, every foreigner, amazing.
At one of the first stops on the tour, me and Kazaki are crouching together inside a toilet stall, examining an instrument panel on the wall with 11 different buttons. One button simply says rear. If you sit down and press it, the toilet washes you with jets of water.
Oh, this is washer. Washing the
backside.
Backside and dryer.
It washes your backside and dries you off, Kazaki says, with warm air, like a hair dryer. When you're ready to leave the bathroom, just press the open button and the doors slide apart, elevator style.
And now the open, if you finish.
High-tech functionality is only part of the toilet's appeal. Many flock to see the imaginative architecture. One, next to a busy park, has transparent walls, colored lavender or green. You can see right into the stalls. Sounds disconcerting until you realize that by going in and locking the door, Whoosh! The walls turn opaque. No one can see inside. Another set of toilets is housed in a white glowing cube. Here's architect Su Fujimoto.
It is quite exciting to create new definition of public toilet, something beyond the normal dirty public toilet.
Fujimoto is a big name in Japanese architecture. He has offices in Tokyo and Paris. The toilet project he designed was inspired by fountains in ancient Rome, historically a place to collect fresh water. It's a touch of serenity in a hectic part of Tokyo.
It is kind of a chaotic situation. So this pure whiteness is showing a strong identity, like cleanness and something really open and welcoming.
Cleanliness is a guiding principle of the Tokyo Toilet Project. Each toilet is scrubbed down thrice daily. As for the voice-operated toilet, its designers were aware that many people hate touching anything in a public bathroom. So they imagined one where you don't have to touch the doorknob, the faucet, or the toilet handle. The whole thing runs on verbal commands. From the outside, it looks like an immaculate snowball, the size of a small house. Supposedly, you just say, "Hi, toilet," and sliding doors open right up.
Hi, toilet.
Hi, toilet.
No. Hi, toilet.
But it's not working. So we press a button that says open and go inside, into a white-walled room with a commode in the corner. It's supposed to play rock, jazz, ambient tracks, and get this, a special frequency that apparently helps you, you know, go. But we're not having any luck making the toilet respond.
Hi, toilet. 音楽お願いします.
No dice. Outside, I meet a Canadian tourist, an architect, on a similar pilgrimage as myself. Her name is Dami Lee. Before I showed up, Lee went inside and tried to lock the door with her voice.
I thought it was understanding what I was saying. I thought it was locked, but it wasn't. Somebody came in. Yeah, that was kind of an awkward situation. I couldn't get it to work.
But I've come too far to give up. I go back in there, determined to start a dialogue. I ask it to play a song. And in the faintest voice, the toilet finally talks back.
Say it again, slowly and clearly.
Say it again, slowly and clearly. Okay. I tell it, please play pop music. And if I strain my ears, I can hear it. Japanese pop song, faintly emitted from some tiny little speaker. It's not quite what I imagined, but for a toilet, a public toilet, not half bad.
Have a nice day.
Okay. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Tokyo.
Bit of J-pop from the Japanese pop duo YOASOBI, a band that first got together in 2019. Compare that to Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra. That band's been around since 1989 and it's still going strong. Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra, or TSPO for short, is a collective of 9 veteran musicians with a shared love for ska, jazz, and rock. This tune, The Last Ninja, combines elements of all three. The action-packed music video has James Bond vibes, complete with ninjas, samurais, and of course, a love interest. New music from Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra brings us to the end of today's show. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend, and join us right back here on Monday.